On October 1, 1976, 21-year-old Ronnie Long, a young black man living in North Carolina, was convicted of robbery and rape. According to an article on IndieWeek written by Erica Hellerstein in 2018, Long's alleged victim was the 54-year-old white widow of a well-off executive in the area. He was sentenced to two consecutive life sentences and has been in prison for the last 43 years, yet he still maintains to this day that he is innocent.
Welcome back to Courtroom Equality, Episode 16. We are your hosts, Katie DeBenedetti and Sophia Cullinan. This week, we will be discussing racial bias in jury selection and what we can do to patch the holes in the selection process. Ronnie Long's resilient and vocal objection to his sentence has brought a lot of media attention his way, especially as the question of racial bias in the courtroom has come into the limelight over the past few years. Long himself, who was convicted by an overwhelming lack of evidence by an all-white jury, calls his sentence a, quote, modernized lynching sentenced by law.
His horde of supporters, who are vocal via social media with the hashtag #FreeRonnieLong, argue that the objection to racial bias in jury selection set by Batson versus Kentucky in 1986 is enough to demand a second look at Long's case.
When we came across this story, we were immediately intrigued by the apparent lack of justice in the case and the lack of change thereafter. We decided to research the exact precedent that Batson v. Kentucky set and how it is put into effect in court today. Batson v. Kentucky is at the heart of Long's case. He claims that his right to an impartial, bias-free jury was violated. In this 1986 case, Batson, a black male, was found guilty of burglary by an all-white jury. According to documentation on OIA.com, the prosecutor used his peremptory challenges to strike down four black jurors with no legit standing other than skin color. The Supreme Court ruled that the prosecutor's striking actions violated the Constitution under the right to an impartial jury and the right to equal protection. Today, Batson v. Kentucky continues to be the grounds on which racial bias is kept out of jury selection. Its precedent constitutionally guarantees that people with standing trial will be judged by a diverse jury. While it is difficult to deny that bias continues to exist in the courtroom, many question whether or not Batson v. Kentucky is enough to keep racial discrimination in jury selection at bay. With so many popular ongoing cases like Ronnie Long's, can we be certain that Batson v. Kentucky and its precedent are enough? And if it's not enough, what changes need to be made?
One way that Batson v. Kentucky appears in the courtroom is during jury selection. If a judge or attorney chooses to strike a juror based on peremptory challenges, meaning they can strike someone without having to provide reasoning, Batson v. Kentucky sets the precedent for Batson-Wheeler motions, which allow attorneys and judges to question the strikes if they believe that they are racially charged. According to SantaClaraCountyGov.org, this is a three-part process in which first, an attorney or judge can issue a motion to another attorney, forcing the attorney who struck a juror to give a race-neutral reason for their decision. Then it is up to the court to decide if the discrimination of the attorney is warranted and purposeful or not.
If it is found that the strike was based on race, the consequences are huge. Attorneys will lose their job, mistrials will be called, etc. For this reason, some attorneys are cautious in issuing Batson-Wheeler motions. When we asked District Attorney Tom Cullinan about his experience with the motions, he emphasized his hesitance to use them.
That's opening a can of worms. What I am doing, if I make a Wheeler-Batson motion against the defense, I'm calling them racist.
Yeah.
I shall not, in my practice, ever do that. It's not worth the risk. Because if I'm calling a defense attorney a racist on the record in front of a Superior Court judge, that means the evidence against that person must be so overwhelming that that particular incident would be sustained by the court. I've never seen it, and I made a promise to myself never, ever to use it.
We then looked into cases since 1986 in which racial tension ran high, specifically looking to see if Batson v. Kentucky was able to combat racial bias in the jury selection. One case in which Batson v. Kentucky was used to defend the impartiality of the jury was Edmondson v. Leesville. Edmondson, a black male, sued Leesville Concrete Company, stating that the company negligence led to a personal injury while on the job. Again, according to OIA.com records, Leesville lawyers viewed 2 out of 3 peremptory challenges to remove black individuals from the jury and were unable to offer race-neutral reasoning for the strikes. Edmondson cited Batson v. Kentucky in his request to the courts to force Leesville to cite race-neutral reasoning. The lower courts denied the standing, stating that Batson does not apply in civil proceedings. But the Supreme Court reversed this ruling, verifying that peremptory challenges may not be used to exclude jurors on the basis of race in all trials.
However, there have also been many cases in which Batson v. Kentucky was obviously ignored. One such case is Flowers v. Mississippi, written about on the Marshall Project in an article written on March 18, 2019, titled "A Racial Pattern So Obvious Even the Supreme Court Might See It." It focuses on Curtis Flowers, a black man in Mississippi who has been tried 6 times for murdering 4 furniture store employees in 1996 and has been found guilty all 6 times. This case was just argued in the Supreme Court in March of 2019, but the question at hand is not whether Flowers is innocent or guilty. Instead, it focuses around the district attorney, Doug Evans, and his continuous striking of black potential jurors. In the 6 rounds of trial that this case has gone through, Evans has struck 41 of 43 black jurors, not accepting a black juror onto the official jury until the 6th trial. The first 5 trials ended in either a hung jury or mistrial because of Evans' misconduct, including his racial bias. This case is still pending for decision, but according to Chris Kemet, the decision, quote, will tell us a lot about the court's commitment to eradicating jury discrimination. Due to cases like Flowers and Longs and a slew of others that have resurfaced with the topic of racial bias hot in the media, it is clear that Batson v. Kentucky and Batson-Wheeler motions are not enough to keep bias out of the courtroom. When we talked to public defender Samute Friedman, she emphasized the disconnect between many juries and defendants, which affects the outcome of the cases.
Yeah, I definitely think it's important because, you know, you have to remember as a public defender, we represent people who are indigent, people who cannot afford an attorney.
Right.
And just based on kind of the wealth inequality in San Francisco, but I would argue anywhere, most of the people who can't afford to pay for a lawyer when they're charged with a crime are either black or Latino, and they're all poor, right? Like across the board, right. They're poor, but then within that poverty, you have a disproportionate number of those people are going to be black and Latino. We have some other groups like Samoans and Tongan people are overrepresented in the population of people that we represent. But, you know, because those are our clients, you definitely want a jury that's going to maybe just be able to sympathize and empathize with their situation or at least see where this person may be coming from and not just kind of see them as an other. So it's really important to get a jury that's diverse and not just racially diverse, but just diverse in experiences, diverse in socioeconomics, and also diverse in maybe, just mm-hmm. walks of life. You don't want everyone on the jury working in tech. You want some people who are teachers. You want nurses. You want doctors. You want people who work in restaurants, right? Because you want a cross-section of the community to be sitting in judgment of your client.
Both Ms. Freeman and Mr. Cullinan did address what they do personally to ensure diversity on their juries. First, we talked to Ms. Freeman.
I think it depends on what type of case it is. If it's the type of case where I feel like, you know, I want the jury to really focus on the law and it's a very technical kind of case, then I might pick, you know, maybe jurors with a science background or who are software engineers or who work with computers because those people tend to be very analytical.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's a case where maybe race or socioeconomics plays a factor in the case, maybe there's something in the case about bias or prejudice or like a stop that wasn't all the way lawful, then I will be focusing questions in my blog here about, you know, people's relationships with people of other ethnic groups or maybe other socioeconomic classes than they are. And I can ask those questions. I usually don't ask them directly, but I ask them in kind of how, you know, maybe what neighborhood they grew up in or, if when they look around their group of friends, if maybe their friends all look the same or they're from the same background and why they think that is. So those are some things that I explore in Blood Year.
We got a similar response from Mr. Cullinan.
I'm always looking for fundamental fairness, no matter what I do. There's more to being a prosecutor than just winning convictions. You have to follow the law. You have to support what's appropriate, what's right. In my jury selection, I'm looking for people who do not have bias against the prosecution's case. When I see that, I will make a peremptory challenge against that person that that person could not be a fair juror. The due process that will protect that person will always be in play, and I will always be generous in my application of due process for potential jurors. Instead of striking them, it's important to have an understanding what their hidden biases are. And if they are enunciated well enough, there's no problem in me removing that juror. It's not a violation of the Constitution under Wheeler or Batson. And so I look at it as fundamental fairness, but I'm also looking to see if a juror possesses a bias that would substantially reduce my availability or potential to win. The main point is, one of the questions I ask jurors of color, if the defendant is of color, is whether or not they would hold me to a higher standard, which is beyond a reasonable doubt, before they could convict. And I've had jurors say, yes. Well, if that's the case, then that particular juror has indicated a bias, and my removal or striking of that particular juror would not be subject to a constitutional hearing.
Though it is great to hear about how individual attorneys are protecting diversity, systematic change still needs to occur. The question that we want to leave all of you with is how we can go about eradicating that bias nationwide.
One solution that has been widely and hotly debated by the legal community is professional juries. Around the world, countries are turning to juries of trained professionals to hear cases and interpret the law. This is because they believe that people who are being paid to listen to cases and have a vast knowledge of the Constitution are more likely to base their verdicts on facts than feelings. However, when we asked both Ms. Freeman and Mr. Cullinan about professional juries, we got an overwhelmingly negative response.
I don't think having professional jurors would be any better than a lay person coming in to hear the same evidence. You're only going to have people who sit on these cases over and over and over again hear evidence similar, but they shouldn't be biased by that. How can you not be biased by what you've heard over and over and over again? And just that simple understanding indicates to me that a professional sworn juror who had heard these cases over and over and over and over again would simply move into a position in their minds saying, oh, here's another one who's guilty. We can't have that.
What about like something in the middle? A lot of people think that jurors should be compensated for their work on juries, you know, being paid while you're sitting on a jury so that maybe they're more likely to take the time to hear all the evidence and review all the evidence. What do you think about something like that? Like, not necessarily professional, but, you know, have make it easier for people to serve on juries.
I can't see how monetizing jurors any more than they are now, which means they get enough to pay for the parking at a usual Hall of Justice in whatever county in California. But it's our Constitution at work. And just throwing more money at them is not the way to go. Different counties are going to have different budgetary problems. They can't afford that. They can't afford to pay jurors more. I understand that. But that means, is a jury in San Mateo County or Santa Clara County, they're going to be paid more than someone in Del Norte County or some other Siskiyou or something like that? No, you can't do that. It's got to be the same. So adding money to the situation is not, I think, a panacea for making things fairer or not. I think it would just, it would cause more trouble.
Well, I would have to find out a little bit more about who are the people that are going to be these quote-unquote professional jurors. And again, you'd have to make sure that it was a cross-section of the community, people who maybe before they became professional jurors came from all walks of life. And so you wouldn't want to create a situation, right, where all the professional jurors were retiring, mm-hmm. or all the professional jurors were one race or one gender or one socioeconomic status. So it's an interesting idea. I'm not saying it's not a good idea, but I think that one of the benefits of jury selection and of juries is that that cross-section of the community changes all the time, right? Anytime right. you turn 18, you become a juror. And so if they were going to do professional jurors, they would have to at least maybe have a term of only 1 or 2 years, because you want to keep the jury pool fresh. You don't want to just have a bunch of people who've been on it for like 15 or 20 years. So if it's done, it would have to be done in a really thoughtful and intentional way. Mm-hmm. But I think our system now, it's not terrible. If we could just work on some of its shortcomings, I think it could be a system that works and could be a system that gives you the diversity.
Though these cautions are important and need to be addressed, it is hard to overlook the positive effects of a professional jury system like the one in France. In France, they separate cases into two categories, civil and criminal. Civil cases are decided by a panel of professional jurors exclusively, as they are generally more clean-cut. Criminal cases, however, are heard by a panel of 9 jurors, 6 laypeople and 3 professionals. This balance ensures that the professionals cannot override laypeople, but it also allows for the jury as a whole to have more informed and less biased perceptions of the case.
The results of this system are shocking. According to data accumulated by HandShare over the past 2 decades that has been verified by the Metal Justice Project, the United States has the highest wrongful conviction rate, with 3,517 people annually. France has a total of just 26 wrongful convictions a year. That's 1 in every 93,034 Americans, compared with 1 in every 2,576,538 French who were wrongly convicted annually. This statistic makes the professional jury system seem like a positive option, so we wonder why both attorneys we talked to were so against this option. What makes American juries so different? We'd love to hear your thoughts on the issue or any possible solutions to this problem that you have thought through our Facebook group at Courtroom Equality Podcast. Remember to subscribe and rate our episode, and we will see you next week.
We'd like to say a huge thank you to both Ms. Freeman and Mr. Cullinan, who graciously allowed us to use their voices in our podcast. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.